Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. You know what sounds good on a Wednesday in early July? Settling down with the Senate's healthcare bill and trying to actually read the thing. That's what sounds good to me. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, as I said, the 5th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Healthcare in a minute. First, though, cars. Tesla and its CEO Elon Musk get all the glory in the electric car business. Heck, we led this program on Monday with news the much-awaited Model 3 will soon be upon us. Maybe soon, I should say, given Musk's penchant for overpromising. But the fact is, Tesla is still small beans in the global car industry, which made today's announcement from Volvo all the more interesting. The company says its new models, starting in 2019, are going to be hybrids or all-electric vehicles, and it laid out a plan to get rid of internal combustion engines entirely. Volvo, of course, has its origins in Sweden. It is now Chinese-owned, where there is a big push on for the electric vehicle market. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains the global EV economy.
So, China's making moves to dominate the electric vehicle market. Volvo is owned by automaker Geely, a Chinese company. Is there a connection? Alicia Webb is editor of the Automotive Buy-Sell Report and has watched China's market for years. She says, yeah, there's a connection, but don't go all conspiracy theory.
The two are definitely linked, but I don't think that you can assume that this is some China play. I think it's safer to assume it's a Geely play.
It's a smart play for several reasons. One, continued access for both car makers to China's market. Sam Abu El Samid is an analyst with Navigant Research.
The Chinese regulators want cleaner, more efficient vehicles, and China is the market where Volvo has been experiencing the greatest growth in recent years.
He says overall auto sales in China are on track to hit 28 million this year. That's about 11 or 12 million more cars than U.S. customers will buy. Capturing more of the Chinese market means obeying China's stricter and stricter emission standards. Yunxu Wang directs the China Center for Energy and Transportation at UC Davis. He says Volvo's shift to hybrids and electrics means more wiggle room.
Geely can claim Volvo as part of its group and using Volvo's EVs to compensate.
Compensate for other cars Geely sells that do have higher tailpipe emissions so that overall, Geely winds up looking extra green in the eyes of Chinese regulators, who are eager to make China the world leader on fighting climate change. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Here is an official statement from the President of the United States issued on Monday. Quote, gas prices are the lowest in the U.S. in over 10 years, exclamation point. I would like to see them go even lower, end of quote. For the record, because facts matter, gas prices have been lower in the past decade than they are now, but they are low, and hoping they drop further seems like a perfectly reasonable, even patriotic sentiment, because who doesn't like cheap gas? Shocking no one, though, the full picture here is a little bit more complicated. Marketplace's Ryan Kailoff has it.
You don't need an econ textbook to understand why cheap gas is a good thing. It puts more money in your pocket. Then you spend or invest that money. And cheap gas helps businesses, too.
Oil is extremely important to the U.S. economic engine.
Ed Hirsch teaches at the University of Houston. He says cheap oil lowers costs for companies from Coca-Cola to Amazon, and that also boosts the economy. But
it's a two-edged sword, of course.
Hirsch says falling prices in the past few years cost the oil industry $200 billion in capital and 200,000 direct jobs. Now, according to the textbook, that's okay. Any hit the oil industry might take from low prices is balanced out by the gains everywhere else. But Hirsch says this time's different.
The hit to GDP had greater impact on the U.S. economy than the lower gasoline prices.
The economy's changed in two big ways since the textbooks were written. First, we aren't spending the money we save on gasoline like we did before the recession. Second, the U.S. oil industry's gotten about twice as big in the past 10 years. Russell Gold is author of The Boom, how fracking ignited the American energy revolution.
10 years ago, we're importing 10 million barrels a day of oil. We've knocked that down to about 8 million barrels a day.
Gold says low prices were great when we were buying more of our oil from Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. Now that we're the ones producing it, that discount isn't really in our favor.
If you're the country that's producing the oil and you're not getting very much money for the oil, you're talking about layoffs. You're talking about less revenue for government.
With this new calculus, Gold says, lower gas prices might make consumers happy at the pump, but they're paying the price elsewhere. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, tech hire. Pretty much everybody else treading water will have the details when we do the numbers. Congress is still off for its 4th of July recess. They are back next week, which means, on the Senate side of the Capitol anyway, health care. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he is reworking his bill. But here's the thing. If you actually sit down and read the 140-something pages of the Better Care Reconciliation Act, like the actual text of it page by page, it's really hard, unless you're an expert. So we called one. Nicholas Bagley is a professor of law at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Let me, first of all, ask you how you think about reading these bills, because you are not a layperson in this field. You have some expertise. So how do you go about it?
Well, it's hard. You know, these bills are the latest layers that are added on top of many, many other bills that have come before in the healthcare space. And so when you read a bill, what you have to do is have all the bills that came before sort of at hand. So you understand when they say we're amending subsection A of subparagraph 1, you know what that's referring to.
All right, so let's dive in here. I want to get you to section 134 of this bill. The block title is Flexible Block Grant Options for States, and it says, and I got to quote the law here because I need you to take this apart for me. Quote, Title 19 of the Social Security Act, as amended by Section 133, is further amended by inserting after Section 1903A the following new section. And then it goes on. So first of all, are we going back to the Social Security Act of 1930, whatever it was here?
Yeah, we're going right back to when the Social Security Act was first adopted back in 1934, I think. Title 19 of the Social Security Act, however, was added in 1965, and it refers to the Medicaid program, which is the joint federal-state program of health insurance for poor people. Section 134 says, hey, you know, states, you traditionally will cover health care for your residents. We've decided to put a cap on how much we're going to help you spend. But we're going to come up with another option for you, too. If you want to take federal money and use it kind of however you see fit to provide health care for your citizens, we'll do that. We'll give you a block grant. And that's Section 134 of the Act, which you've been talking about, is this block grant option. Some states will take it. Some states won't. But it's one of the things that has opponents of the Senate bill up in arms.
And you have to sit there with all those bills back to the Social Security Act to figure out what's going on.
You have to know what it's targeting. You have to pull up the U.S. code. I mean, all legislation is kind of like an old Roman city, right? Like the lowest layers are the things that happened first. And then over time, amendments and changes are layered on top. And to understand it, you really have to read how the statute has been shaped and reshaped over time.
All right. Let me dig into another slice of this, which is that not only do you have to peel back the layers, you have to know your dates and your details. Section 119, quote, repeal of net investment tax, subpara A, in general, subtitle A of the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 is amended by striking chapter 2A, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. And then it gets to effective date. The amendment made by this section shall apply to taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2016. So obviously a year or something in the past. What does this mean? What is the net investment tax? And what does that date have to do with reality?
Yeah, this provision is relatively straightforward as statutory drafting goes. This,
sorry,
I know it doesn't look it, but it really
laughing.
Is. It wipes out a 3.8% tax that Obamacare imposed on the capital gains of people who make more than $200,000 a year. The point of repealing this tax on capital gains is to encourage people to invest more of their capital. And whatever you think about that goal, all the action is really in the effective date of this statute, because the provision is retroactive to the beginning of this year, and it can't possibly affect investment decisions that have already been made. So what we're seeing is the Senate bill offering a pure giveaway to some of the wealthiest Americans, kind of lodged in a very technical, dry provision of their healthcare legislation. Reading statutes is all about the details. And, you know, when members of Congress want to hide something or don't want the public to notice, they will use squirrely language. They will use anodyne language to make it seem like they're not doing very much. But the devil is always going to be in the details.
Nicholas Bagley, he is a professor of law at the University of Michigan. Professor, thanks so much for your time. I do appreciate it.
Very happy to.
Looking for a new job has never been anybody's idea of a good time. But as unfun as it has been in the past, it's getting less fun now, harder and more complicated as well. This country is basically at full employment, and yet companies are pickier, they are less responsive to prospective employees, and they are not exactly welcoming overall. And as candidates have to jump through ever more hoops, Ashley Milne-Tite reports that maybe the whole hiring system could do with an overhaul.
Kristen Shattuck began job hunting last year. She's an education consultant, and she found the process much more involved than the last time she was on the market in 2011. Before an interview, organizations were asking her to submit strategic plans, proposals,
problems to provide solutions for. There were videos to watch,
which she then had to give written feedback on.
And so the amount of pre-work that I was doing for most of these jobs was anywhere from 6 to 10 hours of pre-work. And these were for interviews that I didn't even go sit for.
They were phone or Skype interviews. A couple of times, organizations asked her to submit some work she was proud of from a previous job. There was this project she'd led on teacher effectiveness. It had taken months to complete.
And I was asked to produce it. And the first time I did, and then found out later that they were using it in the organization, even though I never received a call back.
Journalist Rachel Shalom can relate. She spent 6 months searching online for a job.
So I'm logging in to the News Nerdery Slack channel, which is...
She's a digital editor who was laid off at the end of last year. During her search, she put in 71 applications, had more than 20 phone interviews, 6 in-person interviews, and got 1 job offer.
One of the things I noticed through this process was just the power that hiring managers have to influence small things in people's lives. So, you know, the time that you lose sleeping because someone didn't get back to you, or the anxiety that you have wondering whether you should renew your lease or not.
She was always waiting. She received rejection notes less than half the time. Then, after filling out forms, submitting a proposal, and doing several phone interviews, she had an 8-hour interviewing day on the other side of the country. At the end, the manager asked when she could start. She flew home and waited.
And I sent a follow-up email because I hadn't heard from him. And then he told me that they had decided that I wasn't the right culture fit.
So why do job hunters have to go through all this? Alison Hemming runs The Hired Guns, a New York City recruiting firm. Her clients are digital companies.
They're looking for more and more out of each individual person that they hire, and this is their way to manage the risk. I think some of it can be ridiculous and too long.
But she says candidates need to look at it like dating. You wouldn't want to marry someone after the first date, right? She says these interviewing marathons are a way for companies and candidates to make sure you're the one. Still, she agrees hiring managers, like some dates, could be better about the letdown.
There's no clear process sometimes in how to give somebody bad news. It makes people feel uncomfortable, so they don't do it. And so make sure that the people that aren't getting the job understand why.
But Rachel Shalom says that's just the problem. Getting useful feedback is all but impossible. She used to hire people herself, and she knows hiring managers have day jobs and often little training. But she says something has to change.
How you hire is a huge part of your culture.
And a big recruiting tool, or a turnoff for candidates. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I've always dreamed of owning a home with a yard and being able to raise a family.
An ode to white picket fences straight ahead. But first, sure, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down a single point today, basically flat percentage-wise, 21,478. NASDAQ up 40 points, about 0.6%, 6,150. The S&P 500 up 3 points, about 0.1%, 24.32. We mentioned low gas prices cut two ways, one for consumers, another for domestic producers. ConocoPhillips sputtered 0.3% today. ExxonMobil and Chevron both eased off about 1.5%. As we said, the Chinese-owned automaker Volvo announced it's going all electric soon. Volvo parent company Geely up 2.3% today. Tesla, golden boy, as it were, slowed 7.2% today. Bonds rose since the Monday close before the holiday. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.32%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Education policy is, bottom line, all about one thing: getting more kids across the finish line. In this case, the K through 12 finish line. The latest idea comes to us from Chicago, Illinois, where starting with the class of 2020, before anybody can get their diploma, they first got to know what they are going to do next, proof of some kind of plan. Marketplace's Rima Crace looks into what that might take for Chicago's public schools to make it work.
In a few years, Chicago's high school seniors will have to show proof that they've been accepted into college, the military, a trade program, or that they've already got a job lined up. When Maria Ferguson of the Center on Education Policy first heard about this, she thought,
why? Like, what's the rationale?
Ferguson says raising the bar is not enough, especially in a district that's been plagued with low-performing schools and teacher layoffs.
You have to help them get there. People need help to make it to that goal. It is a very lofty and aspirational goal.
Janice Jackson is chief education officer for Chicago Public Schools. She says to help students, the district is raising $1 million to hire 8 more college and career coaches, and it's beefing up counselor training.
I've been a teenager before. You've been a teenager before. We know that things change, but students need additional support in order to really craft that roadmap.
She says the plan will raise the accountability for students.
But it also raises it for the adults in the school because it will be a part of the school quality rating.
Still, some parents, like Jill Wohl, are not fans of what's been called an extremely ambitious plan.
Honestly, I think it is a tone-deaf ivory tower policy.
She says more than half of Chicago's students come from low-income families, and they need more than just higher expectations. They need things like
case managers, social workers, small class sizes, school-based health centers, after-school programs.
A lengthy list for the country's third largest school district. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
It's getting ever easier to operate in this economy without carrying cash. You tip your Lyft driver on your phone, you pay your dinner bill with a credit card, and you Venmo your friends to split the check. Consider then the future of cash. Bashar Chakravorty is the Senior Associate Dean of International Business and Finance at the Fletcher School at Tufts. He's done a number of studies on the cost of cash in countries around the world, and we called him up to talk about the future of hard currency in this changing world. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
The most interesting thing to me about these studies that you did was the idea of cash actually having a cost, and it's a cost in time and accessibility. It's a convenience cost, really.
Well, it's a combination of costs, convenience costs, and time costs. So if you're a consumer, it costs you money to withdraw money from an ATM. Mm. Some consumers, they don't have bank accounts, so they have to go to a place that can cash a check, and for that they have to pay fees. So there's real money there, and then of course to find an ATM and stand in line, that takes time out of the day. So there's an opportunity cost of time, and then of course the inconvenience.
And as with so many things in the global economy, the poorer you are, the more it costs you.
Absolutely. We find that people who don't have bank accounts or are essentially underbanked, they pay 4 times more in fees to get money than those who own bank accounts.
All right, but here's the thing. We are constantly being told that we are headed toward a cashless society. Between things like Venmo and Bitcoin. Do you think we'll get to a cashless future or not?
We'll get to a less cash future rather than a cashless future. In some countries, we are getting pretty close to cashless. For example, in countries like Sweden and Switzerland, they're up there in terms of, you know, pretty much eliminating cash from practically every transaction. But here in the United States, not so much.
What about India, where a number of months ago, the government essentially got rid of high denomination bills, took out some astounding percentage of cash from circulation, period, and yet cash transactions and cash withdrawals now are up over the same time a year ago.
Yeah. So India is, of course, a very interesting case because the government, by brute force, demonetized close to 86% of all currency in on November 8th. And understandably, mobile payments, mobile wallet uses spiked. And now, with currency back in circulation in India, what we are finding is that people are returning to cash. It hasn't come back to the same levels as it was a year back. But, you know, that massive spike that we saw in November, December and January, that has kind of subsided. And people's connection to cash is very hard to break.
Which makes sense if you think about it, right? I mean, it's visceral. If I've got 10 bucks in my pocket, I've got 10 bucks in my pocket. If I've got 10 bucks on a chip in my phone, so what?
Yeah, absolutely. So there is a visceral aspect to it. There's also a rational aspect to it, as in every time I do a transaction on a mobile phone or using some kind of an electronic account, that goes on the record. And the government might come after me afterwards and say, gee, where did you get that money? Or have you paid your taxes on it? And that's a pretty good reason to kind of do everything in cash.
How much money you have in your pocket right now?
Me? Zero.
Nothing?
Zero.
By design, yeah. Or did I just catch you on a bad day?
No, by design. I try and not use cash at all. And in fact, it's extremely awkward every time I'm in a new city and I'm checking into the hotel and I'm reaching to my pocket to give somebody a tip. And boy, you know, I have to say, okay, where's the nearest ATM?
Bhaskar Chakravarti is the Senior Associate Dean of International Business and Finance at the Fletcher School at Tufts. Professor, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kai.
As we learned in the run-up to the financial crisis, home prices can indeed fall. That, however, is small solace to would-be home buyers right now, who in many parts of the country are dealing with a real estate market that is hot and getting hotter, keeping first-time buyers on the sidelines. Housing, then, is today's installment of our ongoing series, My Economy.
My name is Victoria McQuarrie, and I'm a newly married working professional. My husband, Dan, and I moved to Southern California about 5 years ago. We feel financially pretty fortunate right now. We both have degrees from a top 20 university. We've paid off all of our student loans. We both have strong incomes, and we don't have a lot of expenses like kids. I don't think I even honestly calculate exactly how much of my income goes to rent, but it's definitely over that 30%. The housing market is so ridiculously expensive that we feel it's absolutely impossible for us to buy a home. My husband and I enjoy walking around our neighborhood and going to open houses, so we have seen this time and again. We took a look at a two-bedroom, one-bathroom bungalow, 1,200 square feet, and it was listed at $1.2 million. It's crazy. I think owning a home has been, it's kind of this American dream, and I've always dreamed of owning a home with a yard and being able to raise a family, and it'd be nice to build equity in a property rather than just continue to pay rent in something every single month. You know, I think a lot of people who are older than us see the entire millennial generation as one of those, you know, texting, spending all their money on Instagramming their $11 avocado toast at brunch. But a lot of us are working really hard and now feel like because of the market, we can't afford something that our parents took for granted they were going to be able to have, which was buying a home.
Victoria McQuarrie there. She wrote to us from Costa Mesa, California. We want to hear about your economy as well. Drop us a line Marketplace.org/myeconomy is where you can do that. This final note on the way out today brought to us by the ticker symbol HRL. Any guesses? Hormel, purveyor of that delicacy known as Spam, turns 80 years old today, Spam does. Never knew until today, actually, that the name is actually Spiced Ham. That's what it's short for. That's what the company says. Anyway, I did resist the urge, too, to play that Monty Python skit. You know the one I'm talking about. All right, we got to go. The markets I told you about: Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the program for us. Farewell also today to a woman whose voice has been a signature sound on this and all the Marketplace programs for 17 years. Michelle Phillippe has played every part we asked her to play on the air, serious and silly, substantive and tongue-in-cheek. She is, you are not going to be surprised to hear, an actress in real life, which is where she is off to now. And we are going to miss her. I'm Kai Rosenthal. We'll see you tomorrow. Spam, spam, and this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.